It's 4:06, and this is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for spending your Christmas Day with us. We're listening back to some of our favorite interviews from the past year. A little bit later, we'll take a look at the science of bass, why our brains are hardwired to love that low, booming sound, and we'll also hear some of the greatest bass lines of all time.
Now onto a subject that's stimulating for some, panic-inducing for others. We're talking about good old math. Think back to your high school math classes for a second, maybe algebra or calculus. Did you ever find yourself asking, what the heck am I ever going to use this stuff for in real life?
Well, our next guest makes the case that math is much more than X plus Y equals Z, and that it's worth cultivating our math skills. He says they make us better thinkers and help clarify the way we look at politics, the economy, sports, and our daily lives. Jordan Ellenberg is a professor of mathematics at UW-Madison. He's the author of How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking. When he joined us back in June, I asked him how math teachers like him deal with that dreaded question of how math is actually used in real life.
Well, first of all, we do dread it, and the truth is that we don't dread it because it's a bad question. We dread it because it's a really good question, a question that people should be asking us. And in many ways, I don't think our curriculum is set up to really offer a good answer to that question. Sometimes we teach a lot of very formal strategies, a lot of very abstract manipulations, but the truth is that math is not an alien, abstract thing that's separate from our life. It's really woven into the way we think.
And let's follow up that thinking theme. It seems like, if nothing else, when I've done math, I feel a different brain muscle kicking in or something. Is math a good mental exercise?
Oh, I think it certainly is. But again, I think in some sense, doing mathematics is a formalization of thinking carefully. So I hope that when you think carefully about something, you're feeling some of the same muscles exercise that when you carry out a formal mathematical manipulation, if you have cause to do so.
Well, you start off early in the book with one example you offer as an answer to how does mathematical thinking help us out in the real world. And you go back to World War II, I think it was fighter planes and the armor on them. Can you tell us how a mathematician solved that problem?
Yeah, this is an amazing story. And actually, I didn't know it when I started writing the book. I came across it while I was researching and immediately felt, oh, I have to lead with this. So it's the story of Abraham Wald, who was a statistician who worked for this sort of top secret math lab during World War II. You probably didn't even know there was a top secret math lab. That's how secret it was, called the SRG, the Statistical Research Group. And what happens is that the generals come to the SRG and they say, well, we're looking at these planes coming back from Germany and we're seeing that they're not being hit evenly across the planes. There's more bullets on the fuselage, less bullets on the engine. Mm-hmm. How much more armor should we put on the fuselage in order to protect the planes?
Right, and I want to jump in. So the obvious answer, there's more shots per square foot in the fuselage. I'm a general. I want more armor on the fuselage.
Right, you want more armor where the planes are getting hit. And what Abraham Wald says is, no, you got to put the armor where the bullet holes are not. Because the point is that it's not that the planes are not getting hit on the engine. It's that the planes that are getting hit on the engine are the ones that are not coming back. Okay, so what's going on here?
Right.
Is this math? After all, what I just told you, there's no formula, there's no equation, there's no trigonometry. Now, by the way, if you look at Wald's actual report, there's plenty of formulas and equations. Don't get me wrong. I'm not fit for public radio, so we'll hide it. But the point is that he's being a mathematician in that he's questioning the assumptions. He's saying, what assumptions are you making? Are they valid? Did you prove them? Should we think about them? And that's very much the mathematical habit of mind, even if it's not about a computation like you might see in math class.
And he went through and did the computations that show what we'd expect to see if the ones getting hit in the engine were then crashing and not returning, not joining the sample that the generals were working with.
Exactly, which conforms exactly with what the generals were seeing.
And that brings us to the title of the book, How Not to Be Wrong. When we're confronting a problem, an issue in our daily lives, how can we activate our math mind to question those assumptions that leap out at us right off the bat?
Well, I think what you just said, question your assumptions, is a really good place to start because that is what mathematicians always do. Maybe one way I put it in the book is that it's very good to argue against yourself, to the things that you sort of take for granted, to sort of say, well, let me take maybe 20 minutes a day just to sort of say, what if I didn't believe that? What if I believed the opposite of that? What happens if I try to put pressure on my beliefs?
You mentioned that math is often taught in a very formulaic way, or a lot of formulas and formal ways of looking at math. Is there a way to bridge the gap and do that? I assume we still need to do that, but also take this real-world problem-solving approach to make it feel a little more vital.
Yeah, well, that's the question we as math educators have been wrestling with for at least the last 100 years or more. Mm-hmm. It's a real challenge. I think the teachers in this state and around the country are out there very much trying to do exactly that. I think the days when we thought that it was sufficient in math teaching just to generate a cadre of students who can mindlessly follow directions and we no longer think that's enough, and it's been decades since we thought that was enough.
Is the answer the dreaded story problem?
Well, story problems, and actually the state of story problems is a perfect example of how this can go wrong, because I think in the abstract you would say, oh, you sort of connect the problem with a real world thing so that it's more relevant or sort of connects with people's intuition more. But in fact, we've somehow come up with a way of writing story problems which are just the formal problem in disguise. If we say, Julie has 30 marbles and she gives half as many marbles as she has plus 5 more to Rob. I mean, who plays marbles, right? it's just the algebraic problem, like, in a very, very poor disguise.
But isn't that getting us halfway there? Because if half of your students are ending up having Julie having negative 30 marbles or pi marbles or some really wrong answer, and that's what their calculations, it at least invites you to make a check of common sense and the units you're using against the number you came up with?
Well, I hope so, and that's a point I try to make repeatedly in the book. The phrase I use is that mathematics is the extension of common sense by other means. We have to bring common sense to mathematics. And what I say is, if I have a student who gives an answer like negative 30 marbles, if they write that answer and circle it, they're going to get a zero, right? Mm-hmm. But if they write that answer and say, here's what I got, but I know this can't be right because there can't be negative 30 marbles, that's much more credit, because that is actually mathematics, right? I mean, after all, doing a computation, the computer can do now, mm-hmm. right? But actually thinking about what computation that you should do and whether the answer makes sense, that is mathematics, not just adding and subtracting.
Mm-hmm. Well, they could be doing some kind of complicated credit default swap involving marbles, I suppose, where negative marbles are possible. Well, another case where you want people to question the logic, you point out a study that shows all Americans are going to be obese, I think, by the year 2024.
Yeah, it's 2048, I think. We have a little bit more time.
Okay. So that's they took the current trends, the current increase, and drew a straight line, and at 2048, 100% of us will be obese. What's wrong with looking at it that way?
Well, this is a perfect example, because this is called the method of linear regression, drawing the best fit straight line that you can to the data that you have. And I would never say that people shouldn't do this. It's one of the basic tools of all kinds of science. Certainly we should do it, but when we do it, and it works in basically any kind of situation. It's very easy. You can do it pressing one button in Excel. That's the strength of the method, but it's also its weakness, because the fact that it works all the time means that, or works in scare quotation marks, means that you have to actually ask yourself whether the answer you get makes sense. I mean, they're a straight line. It says in 2048, everyone will be obese. But it also says that 10 years after that, 120% of Americans will be obese. So what do we take from that?
Right. So when we're assessing a problem like that, we've got what looks like a linear trend, and we want to figure out what's going to happen in the future. How do we figure out when we can keep drawing that straight line? And this is just ballparking. We're citizens looking at these numbers in a news story. How do we figure out when it makes sense to keep going straight and when that line should taper off, curve a little bit?
Well, this is the kind of thing where giving precise numerical answers to the questions, that's why we have professional statisticians, that's what they're all doing. What the sort of ordinary lay citizen can do is ask what shape of curve makes sense. Because exactly as you said, without any statistical training, you recognize correctly that what's going to happen is that curve is going to bend towards 100%. It has to. There's not literally going to be no skinny people left in the United States.
Well, and I want to take another example, a little more, a vital one in politics. And you say that non-mathematical thinking is maybe steering people on all sides of politics wrong a little bit. Say tax rates. If we have a tax rate of 100%, bad things ensue. I think pretty much everybody agrees with that.
Right.
People stop doing stuff. 0% tax rate, the government doesn't get any money. But what's gone wrong with that? How do we look at it in a linear way versus a curvy way?
Well, so a linear way, it's exactly what we were just discussing with obesity. The nature of a linear relationship is that it only moves in one direction. So in the obesity, it would be to say that as time goes forward, people just get more and more obese at the same rate. And in the language of taxes, it would be to say that as taxes go up, government revenue goes up. But as you just explained, that can't be true because at a certain point, the taxes become so high that government revenue actually goes down. That's sort of a famous old thing called the Laffer curve. Mm-hmm. Now, whether we've actually ever been at that point is a highly contested question. I think most economists would say we have never been there, despite what many people in the 80s wanted to say. But linear means that no matter what, more taxes means more money. Or if something is a good idea, then doing more of it is always better. Put that way, it's sort of obviously false.
Mm-hmm. So one reaction I had to reading some of your examples, and I imagine a lot of people might, is to say that this isn't math. That's politics. The other thing is health. I'm not adding and subtracting. I'm not doing quadratic equations myself. I'm not applying mathematical thinking.
Well, but I think you are applying mathematical thinking in that these questions about what are the properties of lines, that is a fundamentally mathematical question. Now, you may think it's easy, but if it were easy, people wouldn't so consistently get these things wrong.
That's author and UW math professor Jordan Ellenberg making the case that a little mathematical thinking in our lives can go a long way. We'll get to the second half of that interview in just a moment after a look at the news.
We continue our conversation with Jordan Ellenberg, the author of How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking.
And you can join in. Are you a math fan or math phobic? Do you teach math at any level? How do you try to make the case that it's worthwhile? How do you keep your students interested in the math? And what's your favorite or least favorite bit of math that you've encountered? Well, I want to get into improbability and improbable events, Jordan. I think all of us have encountered some event in our lives, thought, what are the odds against that? Something must be behind that. It's such a unique thing to have happened. How do we assess whether something's really that crazily out of the ordinary?
Well, it's a challenge, and part of the reason it's a challenge is that our brains are just not that good at it. In some sense, we're probably designed not to be very good at it. We're designed to see something that looks strange or unusual and notice it, try to make something of it. But in fact, you know, the world is a very big place, and given enough chances for something to improbable happen, it almost definitely will. You could say we live in a coincidence-rich environment.
And this is a problem that goes back and forth in scientific and particularly medical research, isn't it?
Absolutely. So, I mean, one of the things that science is wrestling with right now is partly because we have such a greater ability than we used to be able to carry out many, many experiments, many, many comparisons on a short time scale. We used to be able to say the result of such and such an experiment would be so improbable if the drug didn't work or if the effect weren't there that we can be pretty confident that something is really going on. But now we're in a situation with, you know, tens of thousands of papers being published every year. Inevitably, even if we're studying things that are not real, there's going to be some improbably coincidental things that look like they're major scientific advances. So this is a serious problem that science has been reckoning with.
So there is a probability that some of a huge number of studies will give an improbable result.
Right. The example I give in the book is that if all scientists were simply reading sheep entrails and trying to predict the future, now we think they're not, but imagine that they were. If there were 10,000 sheep entrail readers, some fairly large proportion of them, or some fairly large number of them, rather, would actually get impressive results, right? Like 10 of them would get 1 in 1,000 type results. And if we grabbed those 10 guys and were like, these are the best sheep entrail readers in the country, we might be making a terrible mistake.
And we might end up with that survivorship bias like the fighter planes again, right? If we only pay attention to the sheep guys who are right and dismiss all the rest, we'd have a lot of faith in the sheep.
Right. As they say, past performance is no guarantee of future returns, right? And if you took those same entrail readers and saw how they did next time, you might be quite disappointed in their findings.
Let's get to our callers. We've got Connie on the line in Portage. Connie, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I am an RN, and I had to take algebra in college. And I couldn't see any reason for it. And I was 40 when I started nurses training. And my professor kept saying, oh, Connie, it'll round you out. Well, never did I ever have the need for algebra being a nurse. I think more clinical would have helped, things like that. And my boys are all fantastic in math and use it in their jobs. But I think there's a time and a place for algebra.
Connie, thanks for the call. Apart from being well-rounded, Jordan, do you want to make the case for a nurse doing algebra? Or might there be another way to train us in math that would help us think like a nurse?
Here's what I would say. Algebra in the sense of, can you see a list of 20 quadratic equations and solve them all in 15 minutes? Like, no, you're probably not going to do that as a nurse. And guess what? I actually also don't do that as a professional mathematician. In fact, nobody does that who's not in eighth grade. I hate to break it to all the kids out there who are listening, to break it to their teachers, but that's how it is. But if algebra is doing math in reverse and saying, okay, I need 10 more of these, and I'll have 50. How many do I have? That is algebra, right? That's solving x plus 10 equals 50. It may not be expressed in that way, but that is algebraic thinking, and that is much more like something that you would have to do in life.
Oh, and you make a point, something along, I think you use soccer, but say no football players go out on the field and run in tires and run
right
into inert dummies and things like that, but they still do it.
They still do it when they practice, and nobody says it's not useful for them to do it. Somehow that builds the kind of instinctive skills that they need in order to run away from 300-pound men instead of tires.
Thanks a lot for the call, Connie. We'll go now to Abby with us in Madison. Hi, Abby.
Hi. I am mathematically inclined, and I always enjoyed it. Some of my favorite teachers in school were math teachers, and I am actually dating a math teacher now. But I found that math has been tremendously useful in my life. I'm a PA, and I think it gave me a way to solve problems. If I looked at a problem, it gave me a formula of building blocks of how to go about solving that problem, and I could apply it to a lot of different fields of my study.
Abby, thanks so much for that call. Jordan, that's kind of what you're making the case for.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better, actually, that it's the habits of thought, whether or not they're expressed in what looks like a high school math textbook format that we're really trying to teach.
Abby, thanks so much for sharing that. We go now to Joe in Prairie du Chien. Joe, hi.
Hi. I was a carpenter for years, and I use math constantly to create roof slopes, rafter links, stairs, and so on. But I'm also curious, is the advent of the calculator diminishing the ability to actually understand the mathematics?
Oh, interesting. What do you think, Jordan?
Well, it's a deep question and hard to measure. You could look at it two ways. You could say that people replacing hand computation with calculators may diminish their ability to do hand computations, and I certainly think that's true. Somebody who is more pro-calculator might argue that offloading the computation itself to the calculator might leave more mental room to think about and understand what's going on. If you can have the calculator sort of do 100 questions for you, or you modify it and see how things changes, or better, a computer, maybe that will aid students' understanding. That's certainly the hope of people who are working with tech in the classroom.
But is it important to at least have done the calculation, you know, some before we start turning to the calculator, so we know what went into what the calculator is telling us?
Well, I have strong opinions about this. You want to hear them?
Yes.
So multiplication tables, yes, definitely. Long division, no, I don't care. Again, for the kids out there, I don't care if you know how to do long division, but I do care about multiplication tables.
My kids are probably listening. Long division is still important if your teacher is telling you that, kids. this is controversial in math education, I would think.
Oh, my God. If you go to like a math dinner party, I mean, you can talk about Scott Walker, or you can talk about religion, or you can talk about climate change or whatever, but do not talk about math education. Like, then somebody will leave in a huff. I can promise you that. It is the ultimate controversy for us.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call. We've got Steele on the line in Appleton. Steele, hi.
Hey, thanks so much. I learned on TED Talks about Khan Academy, and I've played with his math classes, and boy, it was a lot better than in high school. That's all I got to say.
Steele, thanks. Are we, not to get back to the controversial math education topic, but are we slowly, asymptotically, moving closer to perfect math education?
Well, it would definitely be slowly, that I could say. I mean, I think stuff like Khan Academy is amazing, and I think in some sense what many people are trying to do, what I'm trying to do with the book, and what somebody like Salman Khan is trying to do with Khan Academy is find ways to take teaching and do it at a larger scale. I don't think anybody thinks we can really replace teaching with that. I think there's always going to be this dialectic between what we can do with one person physically there with a room full of students, or even better, one person with one student talking to them, but also things that we can direct out to thousands, or in Salman's case, millions of people at once.
So we've talked a lot about teaching kids. Steele is a grown-up who's going and learning math. Say we've got other people like Steele out there, didn't really maybe get much out of math or remember much. Is there a field of math that would be a good entry point for people to get back into it and fall in love with it?
Oh, great question. I'm going to sort of say something kind of risky. I would say probability and statistics. Mm-hmm. The reason I say that is because I think it's something that most people didn't learn in high school, so it has the flavor of the new. It can be kind of depressing to like take algebra again when you're 40 years old, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, to do something new, so it's somehow more exciting. The reason it's risky is because I think that subject, as I was saying, is fundamentally pretty hard for us to learn. It's a challenge, right? We're not necessarily automatically good at reasoning about uncertainty, but that's one thing that makes it exciting.
But you can use dice and playing cards and flip coins. That makes it a lot of fun for me.
Absolutely. And it's certainly one of the most relevant and applied areas of math that you could possibly learn.
We'll leave it there for now. Jordan, thank you so much for coming up and joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Jordan Ellenberg, professor of mathematics at UW-Madison. He's the author of How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking. Make sure to let us know how you feel about math over on the Central Time Facebook page.
No expletives, please.
Keep it clean, people.
Coming up after the news, we'll hear about the science of bass and why our brains are naturally attracted to that driving sound. We'll follow that up with a look at some of the greatest bass lines of all time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. The tight bass line kicks off our next conversation. That's Chic with Good Times. What is it about an awesome bass line that really makes a good song pop? Some new research looks at the brain science behind the bass.
And we want to hear from you. What is your favorite bass line of all time? Do you love the bass, or does it just kind of wash over you? Post on the Central Time Facebook page.
In a few minutes, we'll hear from a bass line expert at notrouble.com. First, Laurel Trainer has researched the science of bass and our brains. She's the director of the McMaster Institute for Music and the Mind and professor of psychology, neuroscience, and behavior at McMaster University. Laurel, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So how did you try to analyze the way we hear and process bass sounds?
Well, one of the things that we were really interested in was why the rhythm seems to be carried primarily in the bass range instruments and melodies usually in the higher instruments. So we decided to look at the hypothesis that our sense of timing is actually better for the lower pitched instruments. And so we looked, we presented a series of tones where we had high tones and low tones at the same time. And occasionally we played one of the high tones too early or one of the low tones too early. And we looked at the brain's response to those mistakes in the timing. And what we found was the brain was more sensitive to timing errors in the low tones than in the high tones. And so from that we conclude that actually the brain is better able to encode timing with the lower pitches than with the higher pitches.
And Laurel, is that true across the board for both men and women?
Yes, it is. Both men and women. It also seems to apply across cultures. We didn't study people that were not from Western cultures, but if you look at how music is written across different cultures, it's most often the case that the main bass line, or the main rhythm, the main beat gets set by the bass-ranged instruments.
And do you think we're using this timekeeper function of bass sounds even if we're not actively keying in on listening to the bass?
I do, in fact. I think when we hear the rhythm, and it can be actually in other, you know, range instruments as well, but particularly in the bass, that's what really makes us want to move to the beat. And we also know that our brains are set up so that when we hear an auditory rhythm, it actually activates motor regions in our brain that have to do with timing of movements. It's almost as if it's priming our bodies to move. And it's really these bass instruments that seem to be the main driving force behind that.
And Laurel, I got to ask you, since we're talking about this half hour, do you have a favorite bass line?
Well, there's so many great bass lines out there, it's really hard to say. I'm kind of partial to some Michael Jackson, like Beat It or
Nice.
But there's some other cool bass lines out there too, like Pink Floyd, Hey You. It's a very interesting bass line. But there's so many examples.
That's what I found as I started digging them up too. Laurel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Laurel Trainor. She's director of the McMaster Institute for Music and the Mind at McMaster University.
That's the science. And now we're going to get to the music. Our next guest is Corey Brown, the CEO and founder of NoTreble.com. The subtitle is Nothing But Bass. We asked him to share some of the best bass lines of all times, and he asked the No Treble community for suggestions, too. Corey, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you've got this whole website pretty much devoted to bass. What do you love about it?
Well, it's a funny story. I mean, when I was a little kid, my parents, this is in the early 70s, my parents bought one of those really killer 1970s stereo systems, and we had a lot of albums in the house. And for whatever reason, my dad just cranks the bass on his stereo. And I remember feeling it as a little kid, feeling the bass and the floor. And I wasn't quite sure what that was until I was in the fifth grade, and the music teacher came down and said, "Who wants to join orchestra?" And I was like, "Well, it's music. I want to end," because I was just, drawn to it. And she had me try all the instruments, violin, viola, cello. But when I hit the bass and hit that low E string on the bass and felt that vibration, I knew that was it. I was like, it connected. And I was like, that's the instrument I want to play. So I was about 10 years old. It was a long time ago now. And so, that was my first love in music. That's what I was drawn to. And that's what I've stuck with all these years.
Well, what makes a great bass line? Is it something that's memorable and catchy, or is it the virtuoso performance that's really all over the place? What makes a bass line great?
This is going to possibly get me in trouble with some of our readers because the bass has become such a diverse instrument. It's become a solo instrument more recently than the traditional role of a supportive instrument. And I'll talk more about the old school, the more supportive instrument, and to back up some of the things that Laurel said, scientifically, the musical explanation is that there are three key ingredients to music: melody, harmony, and rhythm. And the bass is actually responsible for two-thirds of those, the harmony and the rhythm. And so it's what propels the music forward. It's what, when a song is grooving, it's because of the bass. And I think, the old school definition of that is it's those memorable lines that whether people recognize, oh, that's a bass guitar or not, they know the line. And so, Money by Pink Floyd is a great example of that. Walk on the Wild Side by Lou Reed is a great example of that. And probably one of the simplest bass lines ever is on Under Pressure by Queen.
Mm.
But they're iconic. And, we were sitting around talking about this before the show, and it was funny how so much of what we kept coming up with were actually the simplest bass lines ever, but they're just so memorable, and they are the song. Come Together by the Beatles, it's like instant. As soon as you hear the bass, and that's what the song is, right? It's the bass line, and as soon as you hear it, you know what song it is. Same with Money, same with all the other ones I mentioned. And, of course, we asked our readers, and because there's such variety and the bass is such a, incredibly flexible instrument, we got a lot of the really technical stuff. So you get a lot of the Geddy Lee and Les Claypool and stuff like that, and they're fantastic. And they can do all the things that I mentioned, but their music tends to be a bit more, I would say more cult oriented and more, you see a lot of musicians at their concerts.
Yeah, you got a ton of responses. It was pretty amazing. And we're going to hear from our listeners, too. You can join us starting right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're going to take a listen to one of Corey's favorite bass lines when he just mentioned Here Comes Money.
So, Corey, bass lines often that ostinato, they repeat the same things again and again. Is that part of what makes them so infectious as we hear that line anchoring the song throughout?
I think for that one, yeah. And like I said, we were kind of surprised when we looked at our list at how simple a lot of the bass lines were. But then one of them on our list was James Jamerson, who had this knack for never repeating a note or a phrase in a line. And he's the gold standard for many of us. You know, the Motown, he was the Motown sound. He was, you know, the, if you watched anything about the, you know, Standing in the Shadows of Motown, it was a lot about James Jamerson and the bass playing he did behind all those great singers.
Well, Corey, based on your audience selection there, I pulled a clip of James Jamerson and Marvin Gaye's What's Going On? Let's give a listen.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you to cry. Brother, brother, brother.
And that's a song. Now, a lot of the ones that your community had, I thought, oh, yeah, that one. And this is a song I love, and there's so much going on and what's going on, right? The vocals, there's horns, right. Keyboard, all the crowd scene. I never keyed in on the bass line. He's doing really amazing stuff in the background there.
He was just, I mean, flat-out genius. I you know, when I listen to his bass lines, I can't even fathom how he did it. And we actually have an isolated clip on the site where all you hear is Marvin Gaye's voice and James Jamerson's bass, and it's like the song is complete. You don't miss the other instruments. It's just, he was untouchable in terms of what he could do on the bass. And I, you know, the Motown, the number one hits coming out of Motown, I think they said exceeded the sum total of the Beatles, Elvis, and the Stones combined. And it was all because of these funk brothers, and anchored by James Jamerson.
So interesting to hear Rob sitting next to me singing the bass line, because I couldn't sing it back to you to save my life, and I know that song. I can sing you the melody, you know, all day long, but that's where my ear goes, to the top of the song, the music, not to the bottom, to the bass.
And Corey, we were talking about this. I'll, like, sing songs to Veronica or to my wife, and she'll be like, how's that song go? And I'll sing the bass line, and my wife, for example, will say, yeah, do you know the words? Some of us key on the bass, and some of us don't. What's up with that?
It's funny, because since I've been playing bass so long, when I tell people I play the bass, and it's changed a little bit over time, but people are like, well, what's that? And they think it's just, you know, we're another guitar player up there if we're playing electric. And, you know, I don't really know the answer to it, but I can tell you this. If you take the bass out of the mix, everybody will know it, and the song will just, it'll die. So, you know, we're like the offensive linemen of you know, the music world. You know, like the receivers and the quarterback get all the glory, but, you know, if the offensive linemen aren't doing their job, nobody's doing anything.
All right, so we got to show a little respect for the bass today, and here to help us do that is Dave in Hustisford. Hey, Dave, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, my pick was Traveling Without Moving by Jamiroquai. The bass player was Stuart Zender. He's now the former bass player for the group, but it's one of those songs where if you, it's impossible not to feel good when you hear it. It's hard not to dance as well, or at least attempt to dance.
All right, thanks a lot, Dave. I don't know that one. What about you guys?
I don't either. I saw you had Jamiroquai on your comments list, though, Corey. Do you want to give props there?
Oh, my gosh, yeah, Jamiroquai, those guys, that's all groove. It's all like, I mean, like the caller said, it's, if that doesn't get you moving, you better check your pulse, because those guys just bring it. And Stuart Zender, the former bass player, yeah, he's definitely one of those guys that just, he's the big reason why.
That's Corey Brown, founder and CEO of NoTreble.com. He joined us back in July to talk about some of the greatest bass lines of all time. We also heard from Laurel Trainer from the McMaster Institute for Music and the Mind. She joined us to talk about why our brains are hardwired to appreciate bass sounds.
We'd love to hear from you on this, too. What is it about that bass sound that drives you nuts? What would you nominate as the most memorable bass line of all time? And how about the greatest bass player of all time? Head on over to the Central Time Facebook page and let us know. Bonus points if you attach a video.
We'll get to the second half of our interview with Corey Brown in just a moment. First, here's a check of the headlines from WPR News.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation about the bass and the best bass lines of all time, listening to one right now come together. Beatles, of course. We're talking to Corey Brown, founder and CEO of NoTreble.com.
And you can come together and give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page with your bass favorites. And we'll go right back to our callers. We've got Mackenzie on the line in Waukesha. Mackenzie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us?
Charles Mingus, not only one of the greatest bass composers of all time, but his Haitian fight song is quite possibly one of my favorites ever.
Mackenzie, thank you so much. This show is an exercise in me kicking myself for not pulling even more clips. And that's the one, how do you leave Charles Mingus off, Corey?
You don't. I mean,
sorry.
You know, like I said, I'm going to get in trouble for missing a lot of people that we should cover, but we don't have enough time.
Can we also give a shout out while we're talking about people who have been left off to Esperanza Spalding, who is, you know, a bass player and I think a rarity in this, a woman, right? Are there seem to be many more men bass players than women?
Yeah, historically that's been the case. And we interviewed Rhonda Smith, who has been touring with Jeff Beck lately, about that. And, you know, we had an interesting conversation about it because it's starting to change. And the reason people, you know, seem to agree it's starting to change is thanks to the web and YouTube. And, you know, so it wasn't an instrument that girls tended to, go to. But now they're seeing people like Tal Wuckenfield, who played with Jeff Beck and others, and Esperanza Spalding, and they have a hero in which to say, oh, you know, I want to do that too. And so we're seeing a lot more players nowadays. And, you know, it may be that they were always there, but we didn't have YouTube. But there is one that is probably one of the most recorded, well, it's definitely one of the most recorded bass players of all time, is Carole Kaye, who did, I think she's recorded on like 10,000 songs from the Beach Boys and Sonny and Cher and all the TV and movie soundtracks from the 60s and 70s. So they were definitely around, they just weren't in the spotlight.
And we have a comment from Joe on Facebook, who's backing you up there on Carole Kaye. He says she played some of the most famous bass lines on some of the most famous pop tunes of all time and got little recognition because she was behind the scenes and maybe because she was a woman.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of those people didn't get credit. I mean, certainly James Jamerson didn't get credit. They just, you know, they would list the singers. So it was the Beach Boys. It wasn't the Beach Boys and the studio musicians. And so I would think it's not because she's a woman, but it was because none of the studio musicians ever got the credit.
All right, we'll go back to our callers now. We've got Joe on the line in Oakfield. Joe, hi.
Yes, hello. Hey, thank you for taking my call. The bass lines I have are not quite as complex as the ones you've been talking about. They're just kind of, I like them because they're simple and they're out front. And the three I have on my list here is White Lines of Grandmaster Flash. That just goes through the whole song. And then Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang. And then Brick House by, of course, the Commodores.
Joe, thank you for those suggestions. We've got Brick House. Let's give that one a listen. And that's one, Corey, you talked about the bass driving the dancing. It's hard even for a non-dancer like me to not move at least a little bit in my seat. That seems like the prototype of make you move bass lines.
I mean, that's it right there. That's Exhibit A. It's awesome.
Are there any other that fit that bill for you, that kind of funky bass line that just locks in with the drums and drives the dancing?
Well, you know, there's a lot of the stuff from the 70s, like, you know, Good Times by Chic. But there's also, you know, you talk about Bob Marley, and his musical director was Aston Barrett. Known as, you know, Family Man, the bass player, and he wrote almost all those songs. And, you know, one of our readers mentioned Stir It Up, which is definitely one of those tunes where, you know, the bass is the big reason for a lot of those songs as well. And you have, like, if you see in the documentary, which is just wonderful, called Muscle Shoals, talks about the studio down in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and primarily the bass player down there, David Hood. And he was behind the Staple Singers' I'll Take You There, which is another one of those just totally iconic bass lines. And all the stuff coming out of Muscle Shoals was just remarkable.
Well, you mentioned Stir It Up there, which is one of my favorites. So let's listen to that one. You could still have that song, I think, if you didn't have anything else but the voice and the bass.
That's right, because you could feel, like, when you're listening to that song, you could feel the bass is pulling you through the song, right? It's driving, it's that harmony and rhythm in combination that's just pulling everybody through the song, and everything else is just kind of a layer over top of that.
All right, back to our callers now with Kevin on the line in Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. My memorable range goes from the classical Pachelbel Canon in D up through, I don't know who did the recording, the opening of the Barney Miller TV show.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't pull the clip of Barney Miller, but I can sing that one.
Yeah, sing it. See, again, I don't remember it. Where's the melody?
Well, that's how it's. But that one starts with just the bass line. It's isolated. It's that it really stands out. Yeah.
Right.
Barney Miller.
That's how the whole theme song starts out.
Yeah. Is that one? Do we know who did that one, or is that an anonymous session musician, Corey?
I don't recall who it was. I really don't.
That's a research project for our listeners. Post on Facebook if you know who did that Barney Miller theme song and played bass on that track. I'd love to find out. I'm curious.
Yeah, I got to go back and listen to it now. Okay, let's take another caller. Thanks a lot, Kevin. On to Rado in Milwaukee. Hi there.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got to say that my favorite bass line would have to be the opening melody from Jackson 5, I Want You Back. That's immediately, for me at least, is a foot tap or no doubt. I mean, that's my simple answer to bass line, my favorite.
We've got it. There it is.
Sounds like another groovalicious bass line.
Yeah,
there.
Definitely. I was listening to this one on headphones, and we had other producers from shows coming in. It's like, oh, I love that bass line. That's one of my favorites. That came up in your comments log too, Corey, didn't it?
Yeah, and I think there is maybe a little bit of disagreement on who that was, but I think the leading vote is Wilton Felder. And, it's just one of those classic bass lines. That, you know, again, you could feel it propelling the song, and everything else is just kind of a layer on top of that.
Corey, do you think bass players get their due these days?
I mean, it's changing, and it's changing with the role of the instrument. When you think about the electric bass, which wasn't invented by Leo Fender, but it was mass-produced by Leo Fender, and so you think about an instrument that's not very old because it started being mass-produced in 1951, and it wasn't even popular then. It's becoming much more a solo instrument. So if you've ever seen Victor Wooten, for example, you know, he can put on a one-man show that is just phenomenal with his bass. And he does it, and many others like him will do it, with looping. And so they'll hit the bass for a percussive sound. It kind of lays down a drum track, and then they'll play like a traditional bass line, and then they'll start playing melodies and chords on top. And it's like a one-man band. Guys like Victor Wooten, you know, those guys are propelling it forward in such a big way, and being the focal point of the music and out front. And, you know, for me, that really started with who I, you know, my number one guy is Jaco Pastorius, who was, you know, just remarkable and played the bass like a horn player sometimes, but could play the 16th note grooves. And he grew up listening to Jerry Jamont, who's a bass player not many people know, but everybody's heard because he was on all those Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles and B.B. King stuff with Atlantic Records in the 70s.
Corey, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was Corey Brown, founder and CEO of NoTrouble.com, talking about the greatest bass lines of all time. If you have a nomination to add to the list, hop over to the Central Time Facebook page and drop it there.
We also heard from Laurel Trainer from the McMaster Institute for Music in the Mind. She joined us to talk about the brain's reaction to bass and why bass just might be the most important part of the song coming together.
Coming up next, we'll hear about a project taking place here in Wisconsin that aims to give a platform to a group of people we don't always hear from, the state's rural residents. We'll hear some of their stories right after this check of the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.